Good evening. Welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Just Enough with Asby Brown, How to Learning from Traditional Japan. My name is Cynthia Miyashita, and I chair the Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum here at the Commonwealth Club. I'd like to also welcome members from the Japan Society of Northern California and also the Asia Society of Northern California, and thank you for your support of tonight's program. Before I introduce tonight's speaker, I would like to ask those of you who would like to receive occasional emails from me about upcoming events from the Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum to please leave your name and email on the sign-up sheet on the credenza in the hall. I'd like to tell you about what we have coming up. In August, we have a club-wide series called The Ascent of Women, and our forum is going to be on Monday, October 23rd, Remembering Afghan Women. Our speaker is going to be Catherine Brown. She is a communications manager for the Asia Foundation and previously served on the White House staff and at the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan. Catherine arrived in Kabul in 2003 at the height of the optimism for Afghanistan's women. The Taliban regime had been overthrown and a ministry of women had been established. A constitution was adopted which guaranteed women 25% of the parliamentary seats. But in succeeding years, progress has been stymied. Over 80% of Afghan women are illiterate, have little health care, and are victims often of violence. Ms. Brown, who will be returning from Afghanistan shortly before her talk, argues that improving the situation of women in Afghanistan is the most cost-effective way to ensure sustainable development. So I hope you'll join us for that program August 23rd. Later on in the fall, we're going to be commemorating the 100th anniversary of Angel Island. There's a new book, a very comprehensive book on the history of Angel Island. This year is also the 150th anniversary of U.S.-Japan relations, diplomatic relations, when Japan sent a tall ship with their first embassy to San Francisco. And so we will be having another program in the fall to talk about that 150-year relationship and the history. Later on, we're going to be joining Eric Gower. He's author of a wonderful cookbook called The Breakaway Kitchen. And we're going to do a blind tasting. It's a very creative cook, and so I hope you'll keep your eyes open for that later in the fall. At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Asby Brown. He's a native of New Orleans. He is director of the KIT, that stands for the Kanazawa Institute of Tokyo, Future Design Institute in Tokyo. He was formerly the Associate Professor of Architectural Design at the KIT Institute. He studied architecture and sculpture at Yale College, graduating in 1980, then entered the Department of Architecture at the University of Tokyo in 1985, under grant from the Japanese Ministry of Education. He received his master's degree in 1988 and completed his PhD research in 1995. He's the author of The Genius of Japanese Carpentry, Small Spaces, The Japanese Dream House, and The Very Small Home. In his new book, Just Enough, Lessons in Living Green from Traditional Japan, he points to Edo Japan to show how we can live happy, fulfilled, and responsible lives today. He writes that people were educated to be conscious of everything they used and to place a high value on food, energy, and materials. More than anything else, Just Enough is about a mentality that pervaded traditional Japanese society and which can serve as a blueprint for greener living today. Would you please join me in welcoming Asby Brown?
Thank you, Cynthia, and I'd like to say thank you to everyone at the Commonwealth Club for having me, and also to the Japan Society and Asia Society for co-hosting the event. Cynthia said, I'm from New Orleans, and I think New Orleans really shaped me in a lot of very important ways. Many of you, I guess you live here in San Francisco, so they're actually very similar. There's a lot of history there. The environment can be very, very supportive. And just as we shape the environments that we make, the environments shape us in turn. And I think that having grown up in New Orleans primed me in a way to be very receptive to learn a lot of things from Japan when I went there. I studied sculpture, which really got me into woodworking when I was in college. And I was very fortunate to take classes from Vincent Scully, who some of you may know if you're interested in architecture, is just a masterful professor of architectural history and really brings the past alive and shows us the continuities that exist and the things that underlie how common values can underlie the way we live. I had wanted to go to Japan because I had a roommate who had lived in Japan, and I had my sculpture professor had lived in Japan, and I really wanted to learn about it. And several years after graduation, I was able to go for a short time. I had a small job, and I made a beeline to a Japanese carpenter. I had really wanted to learn about this wonderful technique of Japanese carpentry, especially temple carpentry, and was very fortunate. A series of chance and mistakes and things led me to a man named Tsunekazu Nishioka, who is considered the last great Japanese temple builder. And I learned a lot from him. I initially thought I would be an apprentice and learn to be a carpenter in the Japanese method myself, but I suppose at the time I was already in my late 20s, and I understood that it was a real ethical commitment for 7-8 years just to be obedient and to totally, submerge my own desires and creative, impulses to learning. And I told the master that rather than be his apprentice, I'd be really happy if he allowed me to just stick around and document his work. And he said yes, and that was a wonderful experience. And I learned a lot from him about things like time, about things like the environment. And I was very, very struck from that point at what I consider to be a great environmental wisdom that influenced every aspect of that craft. And I think the more I learned about other Japanese crafts, they all had that to some degree, an understanding of energy and materials and culture and communication in a way that was very, very precious. So I ended up writing a book about the Japanese carpentry, and then ended up writing a lot of other books. And I didn't really intend to be a writer, but I found that it suited me very well. And while I was continuing my research in traditional Japanese architecture, I got interested in contemporary Japan as well, and particularly compact houses, and gradually sort of circled around to this environmental aspect of them, and as something very important that Japan can teach the rest of the world. My talk today is, I'm calling it the Edo approach to achieving sustainability. Again, because from the outset, I was very aware of this environmental sensibility that informed the decisions of the carpenters and the other craftspeople as they were making their work. I had also heard a lot of anecdotes about particular techniques or ideas or ways of working that revealed a very important value set to me. And after writing a book about compact houses about 5 years ago and speaking at a sustainability conference in Sun Valley, I was really surprised to learn that the sustainability community, these were people who had been working for decades in many cases on their particular fields, like in water purification or in organic farming or perhaps energy or building, and they were really communicating with each other very well. They had reached a point where they were open to ideas and understood that they had a lot to learn from each other. It was reaching a kind of critical mass. And I thought, well, I think maybe these people in particular would be ready to learn about the Japanese way of doing things. And I went back in 2006 to Japan and started to do my research from this angle, from the environmental and sustainability angle of the Japanese traditional lifestyle. The Edo period of Japan, I think a lot of you are familiar with Japanese history, but it really began in the early 1600s, lasted until the middle of the 19th century, a period of about 250 years. And at the beginning of this time, it was the end of the period of great wars, which saw a lot of massive defensive building projects, a lot of urban planning, urban building, and a lot of destruction of the environment. In fact, they were facing deforestation It was beginning. They were having to go further and further afield to find timber for building projects. The things they had to do, the works on the river they needed to do to modify them to ship timber were actually damaging the watershed. This damaged watershed was making it difficult to maintain agricultural productivity at a time when the population was increasing. It was a lot of problems sort of linking together at once. But over the course of several generations, they were able to halt and basically reverse the environmental damage that they had caused and lead to this very sustainable society, or what we would consider a sustainable society today. In Ryoanji Temple in Kyoto, maybe some of you have been there, there's a wonderful water basin, and the characters, they all are based with the character of the mouth in the center, so it's kind of a visual pun, and it says, Ware tada taru o shiru. And this means, well, I can translate it as, I know what just enough is. And the way that the Japanese society was able to implement policies and sort of change the way that they were interacting with their environment, it required a certain amount of input from the government, a certain amount of top-down, but basically it was a way of merging the process, the designs, with existing values. And I think this Zen value of knowing what just enough is a great example of that. It stresses restraint. We know that Zen culture influences Japanese culture to a very deep degree. As it does Shinto culture, which also has a very special relationship to nature. And this idea of sufficiency, of knowing when to stop, of trying to avoid excess, was very, very important in allowing them to achieve this sustainable lifestyle. So we think of things like water and forests and energy, waste, food, as sort of discrete problems or discrete aspects of our lifestyle that we can perhaps approach in isolation. But in fact, of course, they're all very, very linked. And there are vectors that link things like water and energy, or the waste in the forest, or food and everything else. And as we, if we understand those and take them into account when we're making decisions, for instance, how are we going to source our food, or how are we going to provide water for our cities, it can lead to a great mutual reinforcing. But in many cases, what had begun to happen in Japan and what's happening with us now is a catastrophic interaction. In other words, when one aspect starts to crumble, well, it's like a domino effect. And we're really seeing the beginnings of this. It's easy to deny it or think that the people who appear to be alarmists are overstressing, but I really don't think it's alarmist. And what we need to do is what the Japanese did and create instead a virtuous cycle where the solutions we arrive at for each of these problems, like water, actually provide solutions for the other aspects as well. And I think we should call these multi-form solutions. In other words, one solution that answers many questions at once. Everything ultimately comes down to the landscape, the natural carrying capacity of a natural environment. In the case of Japan, it's a small country in terms of land area. It's about the size of the United States West Coast, kind of stretching from Washington down to the Southern California, but only about a quarter of it, or less than a quarter of it, is really arable land. It's flat enough for agriculture. The rest is very, very mountainous. And this is a remarkable thing. The country in the Edo period had about 30 million people. It supported a very large population, population similar to like Venezuela, maybe some smaller European countries as well. And the city of Edo, which most of you perhaps know was what Tokyo was called before the modern period, had well over a million people, 1.3, 1.4 million people. So there's a very, very high population trying to be supported on a very limited land. In most cases, this meant valleys. The valley floor, which had original forest cover, and it was almost always deciduous trees. These were cut down in most cases and made into farmland. The valley floor is devoted to rice farming, which are rice paddies, irrigated farming. The lower hillsides devoted to other crops, vegetables and orchards, etc. Farmhouses are generally sort of nestled towards the base of the mountains, and these lower mountainsides were very, very important to the lifestyle and livelihood of the people. They used them for everything, for gathering food, mushrooms and little ferns and other wild edible plants, which are still kind of an important part of Japanese cuisine, considered delicacies, and which it struck me to learn that the Japanese had been gathering and eating these things since the prehistoric period. So Japan maintains this connection with that. There was almost always a river at the bottom, So the watershed was very important for every aspect of life, although they made quite a few irrigation canals. So the way they handled irrigation was very important. And they also depended on these mountainsides, which we call Satoyama, for fuel. Here's another view, sort of a sectional view, the valleys with the intensive agriculture and the lower hillsides, and these mountains which are accessible. And actually they were legal rights for the villagers to actually have free access to these places for gathering. They weren't allowed to cut trees in most cases, but they could gather. And forestry was generally restricted, especially during the Edo period, as they developed regenerative forestry, which meant they were replanting as many trees as they cut. These were generally carried out in the deep mountains. And they did quite a lot of wonderful engineering that we would consider low-impact engineering to transport the timber. Things they would build trestles and things that would actually go away after the work was done. There's many things I learned about how they sourced materials or used energy that struck me and sort of serve as wonderful models for an attitude that we would do well to learn from. For instance, by and large, in the rural areas, fuel was provided by wood. And they limited their fuel supply to the wood that would fall naturally over the course of the year. In other words, they did not cut trees for fuel. There was charcoal burning, and the urban centers generally depended on charcoal because it was easier to transport, and they used what's called coppicing. They would cut these hardwood trees that grew in clumps and make charcoal out of them, but after 5 or 10 years, they had grown back and could be renewably turned into charcoal as well. But for the average farm village, they really only gathered what fell down. This meant that they limited their fuel consumption to what they knew would be the renewable supply of energy. And they could only do this because they had been living in these valleys for generations, centuries, in some cases, millennium or more. They understood, you know, what supply they would have, and if they didn't expect to have the energy to do a particular thing, for instance, to open a kiln or a blacksmith shop or to build a number of new houses, they simply did not do it. This is really very important to us as we outstrip our energy supply. It's difficult for us. We always assume there will be more, or we'll find a way to make more energy. They said, no, let's just adjust our lifestyle to what we know is available. I think we can learn a lot from the way that the Japanese approach their water supply. For instance, today, it's clear that we're out-consuming our replenishable supply, our naturally replenishable supply. Most of you perhaps know that we're mining fossil aquifers in many parts of the world. These are large bodies of water that are deep underground, just like the oil is, that's been there for a million years. And when that is pumped out, for instance, used for irrigation in places like the Mideast and other parts of the world, when that's gone, it's gone. We have really seriously damaged our water supply. By abusing the hydrological cycle, we've even reduced rainfall in areas, desertification as a result of that. It's really a big problem. The way we use our water has very, very high energy costs for everything from pumping, transportation, purification. This is also a problem. We use it in ways that pollutes the natural supply. Of course, sewage is a very big example of that, but so is industry. And finally, we use so much for irrigation, 70% of our water for irrigation. And a lot of that evaporates and is wasted. Now, there are wonderful advances being made, things like drip irrigation or low water, low intensity water use for agriculture. But in fact, it's really quite a big problem. The Japanese, again, having lived in these regions for a very long time, I believe that they read and understood their watersheds in a way that we would really benefit from. Ultimately, it's the mountaintops. The snow caps on mountaintops that provide the great reservoir for most of the fresh water that we use. I mean, a lot comes from rain and goes into basins and aquifers, etc., but it really comes from these ice caps, which is precipitation. And it stays there for most of the year and gradually melts during the warmer months, and that provides everything that we use. And of course, we're seeing now with the retreat of glaciers that we stand to have serious, serious problems. The Tibetan Plateau, for instance, really may have a lot of problems within a few decades because of that. Natural watersheds have ponds and lakes and sort of holding basins. And the Japanese, when they began this intensive irrigation for their rice paddies, made very good use of those. They basically designed their systems to make use of what exists, to perhaps divert the water in a way, to make artificial channels that would divert it through what are really terraces of rice paddies, but back into the natural watershed, usually from one sort of wetland basin to another wetland basin, and maybe from there into another river. And there's been proven scientifically that these terraced rice paddies, in fact, act as purification systems, that the water that comes out of them is cleaner than what goes in. This is really something we should learn from. All of our water use systems should work that way. If it's industry or agriculture, compare it to our situation where the fertilizer runoff is just destroying oceans and causing algae blooms and horrible things. There's actually improves the overall quality of the water downstream. So this is a kind of a very wise approach. I'm going to get a little sip of water myself now. The Japanese, we think of technologically the Edo period of Japan, pre-industrial Japan, as somehow backward in technology or very, very simple. But in fact, they were quite sophisticated. It was a very technically sophisticated society. The way they provided water for their cities is a great example. They built aqueducts, and the longest ones, the ones that served Tokyo, were well over 30 miles long. There were quite a few. The residents of Edo, rather, the one that served Edo, provided fresh water every day, 24 hours a day. And this is as early as the 17th century. By the 18th, 19th centuries, it was very, very, there were many aqueducts serving the rest of the city. They gradually almost completed the coverage of the city. And this is something that no European city of the time or North American city could boast. So they really solved the problem very, very well. This is a typical tenement courtyard. Most of the commoners in Edo lived in these small apartments, which are sort of very tightly laid out on these city blocks, and there were a shared courtyard with a well that provided water and common toilets and a place for rubbish and other functions. And this water system was basically based on wooden pipes. You know, it was built like shipbuilding, actually, very tightly caulked and put together. And it included provisions that it was designed to allow maintenance. So they had these basins that would allow sediment to settle and could be, you know, had manhole covers. They were like holding tanks or pressure equalization tanks. And they could close off pipes if they needed to, very simply, to do maintenance on other parts or to detect leaks. They did this very, very well. And they used quite a lot of manpower, but they managed it very, very thoroughly. And the well itself is really an artificial well. There was a long a bucket on a long pole, and they would pull that out, and it was very, very good fresh water. And the country was, even though it didn't have a lot of land, it had a lot of a very good water supply. In terms of waste, the problem that we have with sewage, they solved this waste problem in a way that I think is really remarkable. And it's not a solution that was designed all at once. Like many things, it was sort of a series of linked decisions, and they saw how it went and continued to a solution that really had great mutual reinforcement. They used basically latrines, what we call latrines. And these were similar to the kind of toilets that were, you know, we had in North America or in Europe at the time. They developed what we can only call a human waste infrastructure to use this for agricultural fertilizer. Again, before this, they had used what's called green fertilizer, leaves and other organic matter, which they would compost and spread on the fields. And that worked fairly well. But as the population increased, they needed higher production. They used quite several other kinds of fertilizer, including this. So what it meant was that people would go around and empty these things very frequently, which, of course, had great health benefits. Where we had cholera and other disease in all of our major cities in the West, really, Edo did not really have cholera well until the beginning of the modern period. And it was highly standardized, the similar buckets and carts and barges, etc., to get it where it was needed. One of the remarkable things about it was, at the beginning, people who owned, like, you're a landlord and you have a tenement and you have this toilet, you would pay someone to come clean it out for you. We're talking about the early 17th century, but by 100 years later, it had reversed, that the stuff was so valuable that farmers were having bidding wars with each other to get the rights to buy the stuff. The fact is, most waste is valuable. It should be valuable. We should have systems where the waste, the stuff we use, the stuff we make, has a value even when it's finished being used. And it became quite an interesting economic system. So this entire infrastructure included brokerages and transportation systems, and depending on the rank of the person or the nature of their lifestyle, the cost was quite different. And contrast this to ourselves. It meant they did not dump it into the water supply. It's not like they were not technically capable of making a sewage system like ours. They simply decided not to and did it a different way. About half of our freshwater consumption in the household comes from the toilet and from bathing, particularly showers. The way they approach bathing, I think, is also remarkable, and we can learn something from that as well. For instance, there's a wonderful way that people used to bathe. It's called gyozui. And it really means kind of, we call it a cat bath. It means you sort of stand or squat in a bucket and you ladle the water over yourselves. And, you know, this is not unique to Japan. But for instance, during the summer months, they would leave a jar of water out in the sun all day. And by the end of the day, it's gotten fairly warm. Not hot, but fairly warm. After the sun goes down, it's a little cooler in the evening. It's the perfect temperature to bathe with. So it's a natural solar heating, taking advantage of that small temperature differential in order to avoid using energy to heat the water. And perhaps some of you know, hot water in Japan is called OU. It's an honorific. It's honorable hot water, just like honorable tea or honorable father. It's honorable. Perhaps on the one hand, because there were a lot of natural sources, the natural hot springs, which are somewhat divine, but also because of the respect that it requires because of the consumption of energy. So when they found many ways to use water without consuming energy, and of course, after it was done, it would be diverted to the farmhouse pond where it could be used for other things. They could also use this warm water to start a pot of water for tea, which it was already several degrees warmer, so you needed less fuel for that. In the cities, they had public baths, what we call sento. And again, if any of you have been to Japan, you've maybe been to a sento or to an onsen. It's very similar to what it was 200 years ago. You'd come in, you'd pay your admission fee. There's a big room where you can scrub off and get your body clean before you enter the hot bath and soak. Now, what this really means is, you know, you have this big bathtub where, you know, 8, 10, maybe more people can soak at the same time. It's a great economy of scale. You're using less energy to bathe more people. You're also using less water. The price of admission allows you one bucket of hot water. This is the hot water guy back there. He'd fill your bucket, and when you're scrubbing yourself off, that's all you get to use. Cold water, you can use more. So this is really a remarkable thing. Of course, sento have almost disappeared in Japan. Everyone prefers the always-on, always-available hot water system. I know there's other parts of the world. For instance, I've heard that even today in India, middle-class households and even upper-middle-class households sort of do something similar. They have a hot water heater, but they limit their bath to one bucket of water. It's kind of a behavioral characteristic that has been taken advantage of to provide a great benefit on when it's looked at on the overall scale. Materials. Most of what we make and use we can call material culture. And again, our current system is what we call a one-way use, the cradle-to-grave system. Some of you may have read a great book by William McDonough called Cradle to Cradle. He's an interesting sustainable architect who said, well, you know, we need to close the loop and things are not going to end up as landfill. We need to find a way to totally recycle them. For instance, now, even if you recycle paper, you have a nice book, it gets recycled, it becomes newsprint, maybe a coarser paper, and eventually it's going to become landfill or incinerated. It's never going to become fine paper again. The same for plastic bottles. We recycle them. They're not going to become nice, clean plastic bottles again. They'll become like a parking barrier or something else coarser and eventually becomes landfill. What we really need is a system that closes that, where the stuff we use gets fully utilized, can either become the same thing again or in other respects have more downstream uses. The way we source materials now, of course, is very inefficient in terms of energy, both for manufacturing, transportation, packaging, you name it. Quite a lot of our raw materials are on the verge of depletion, and we have a high cost of disposal. Both this is environmental and actual economic cost. The Japanese, to contrast, did a lot of things very, very differently. I like to take the example of rice, the byproducts of rice production. And the rice plant, you know, it has a long stalk and leaves, and the edible part of these little seeds that grow on the flowers, and these are stripped off and they have a hull. It's called a momigara in Japanese. And then that leaves brown rice. And it can be eaten like that. In fact, the rural people, the villagers ate it that way and consequently avoided this vitamin D deficiency that affected the city dwellers who preferred white rice. And then you have left the stalks, which become straw. So these hulls have a lot of uses as abrasives to fill cushions, a lot of uses for that. They can eventually be sent to the farm for compost or fertilizer. The same for the rice bran. It's not really palatable in its initial form, but it's used for pickles. They would fill pouches with it for scrubbing. Consequently, they actually scrubbed themselves very well with these, what's called a nuka bukuro, and didn't use cleansers or soaps that would pollute. But really the remarkable thing is what they did with the straw. They did everything with it. They would use the straw for everything from thatching roofs to making shoes or sandals, raincoats, hats, floor mats, cushions, pouches, almost everything that they needed for daily life. They would make from this byproduct of their food production. And these things were not that durable. They would use them for a year or a season. But one positive benefit from this system was that almost everyone was a craftsperson. I mean, people learned how to make their own sandals. Everyone was making everything just like they were weaving and doing other things at home. And of course, after this initial use, eventually this stuff could also become fuel. And straw, rice straw, had great benefits as fuel because the ash was very high in potassium. When the ash was left over, that could be used, again, for fertilizer or go into production of dyes or metals or ceramics. Ash was sold. It was like you could shovel out your fireplace and someone would come around and buy that from you. So this also had a high economic value. And, of course, entering the fertilizer system into the mulch system, these things return to the agricultural cycle. This is a really, really wonderful system. And I think the things that we produce, the byproducts of our production now, should work in a similar way. I became very interested as well in looking at what happened to buildings when they were demolished. Japanese architecture is wonderful in one respect because it's all put together with joints. This is what really fascinated me in college and why I decided to learn so much about it. It's joinery, joints and pegs and wedges. And this means that they're dismantleable. You can actually take them apart. And they were designed to be dismantled, to be moved, or to be for maintenance. But in fact, when the building's at end of life, they're saying we're going to get rid of this. It meant that they could cart this stuff off. And in fact, there was a high market value for used timber. There were lumber yards in the major cities like Edo that specialized in recycled timber. We think of this as a current thing, but in so many cases, you know, you would simply go, you're building a new storage building, you don't need fresh lumber, the carpenter would find something used for you, and it was possible and it made easier because the design system was modular. These were standard dimensions, basically standard lengths, standard, you know, sizes of the timber. It was very, very easy to do that. Things like roofing tiles, very, very durable. They had a high resale value as well. Cedar shingles, they're dry, they're brittle, they're wonderful for tinder. People could sell them for people to use for their tinder. Lots of other boards and things could be sold, refinished, replaned. If nothing else, they'd find their way into garden stakes or fuel. Bamboo is a very interesting case because in many cases, bamboo that has been seasoned and weathered, or perhaps it's been over the fireplace for a long time, it has a wonderful patina. This is very expensive, you know, that was really prized by connoisseurs of design. Everything metal could be reused. This is one of the only things that in our current material economy that is very, very well recycled is metal. In the case of iron particularly, there was a wonderful system. The iron recycler would, he's a peddler, he's, you know, on foot with his basket, and he would go into the neighborhood and tell the kids, you know, I have candy and toys, you know, you bring me as many used nails as you can find and I'll give you a toy. So that means all the kids in the neighborhood, they scatter and they're under the bushes, they're looking around for nails. In fact, maybe they've been doing this, you know, for a couple of weeks waiting for the guy to show up. Again, it's a behavioral design, you know, taking advantage of what people naturally want to do that they find their benefit for. Things like tatami mats and sliding screens, these are standardized. They can certainly be reused easily. Foundation stones, you know, they're selected to begin with to be the right size and right curvature. They have a resale value. And the walls, which are made of clay plaster, these can just be crumbled and can be returned to the earth. So they're very, very in terms of the environment, very, very innocuous. Clothing as well was very well thought out in terms of use afterward. The garments for women and for men were basically the same cut, the standard garment. We would call it a kimono. Of course, kosode is probably a better term, actual term. And they were simple rectangular panels of cloth. They would have a piece of cloth, one bolt of cloth about 36 feet long, which represented about 36 hours of labor. And these were cut into simple rectangular sections, which were assembled. And of course, that meant they could be disassembled. And in fact, they were often taken apart, always taken apart for laundering. And it meant when it got to be really old or some part was worn out, you could put together a garment from mismatched patches. And in fact, that became a bit of a fashion in Edo at some point. Or you could simply make something else out of it. Maybe a furoshiki, one of these cloths to wrap things, or you're making a different garment, or you're making washcloths, or maybe even a diaper out of it. And it worked very, very well. And the kimono, the kosode, had great virtues of being kind of a one-size-fits-all type of garment, so kids could wear a long one that was too big and grow into it. It was also, this is underwear. Men's underwear is called a fundoshi. Again, it's the most common type is a simple strip of cloth. This is called a rokushaku. It's a 6-foot-long piece of cloth. They'd wrap it around. And this was actually enough clothes for a man to wear in public in most cases. You know, you're a farmer, it's summer, that's all you need. If you're walking to the bathhouse in the city, that's really all you need. It's not considered overexposed. And this was a very common theme throughout Japan in terms of how much clothes to wear. The samurai were more formal. They wore more clothes in general, but average people never wore more than they really needed. It meant there was less textiles consumed. They would be as unclothed as possible to be comfortable. Women's underwear was called a koshimaki. Again, it's a simple rectangle. Same garment fits everybody. It was very, very useful. And there were quite a lot of used clothing sellers in Edo. Not just Edo, but other cities as well. And most townspeople, if they needed, you know, more clothes, they would go to the used clothes store. There were hundreds of them. A lot of them were shops with roofs, you know, but there were quite a lot of itinerant, merchants who would go around, and people would generally go to the used clothes seller first. They would trade in their old stuff for something new. There was no stigma attached to that at all. In fact, there were a lot of itinerant recyclers. There were people who recycled crockery, which we would just throw away or would end up as landfill. They found uses either to repair it and resell it or to pulverize it and use the material for something else, or people who were repairing things like umbrellas or lanterns. The umbrella recycling ecology was particularly evolved. Every aspect, every little, the handles or the spines, everything, they all had uses. The paper, which is this oiled paper, was particularly prized, for instance, by butchers. You know, we think of Japanese people as not eating any meat, but in fact, there were butchers. They liked this old, used umbrella paper to wrap their meat in. So, again, this is finding a value for everything and finding a way to allow people to feel comfortable with reuse, with engaging in recycling behavior and total use habits for their own benefit. So I think that perhaps as we look about our material economy, if we're trying to design or develop a new material economy, it would probably look a lot like the Edo material economy. And I'm not thinking in terms of the actual physical appearance of things. It's about how they work as an overall system, how they reflect that linkage between the water and the forest and the food and the waste that we think of as necessary for leading to a great mutual reinforcement. And that brings me to the end of my talk. And I thank you for being patient and listening. I have a website for the book, and perhaps you've seen the book outside. It's very heavily illustrated. I did all those myself. The drawings took me a year, a lot of eye strain, but I'm really happy about that. And I think we can take questions from the audience now, correct?
Thank you.
Yes, anybody, anything. Yes.
When I saw the clothing sellers that you described right towards the end, immediately reminded of sort of the habit in the 80s and 90s when I lived in Japan, where if you were finished with the television, you just put it outside.
Right.
And that seemed like an extraordinary devaluation of the used and had been replaced by this, like, insatiable desire for the new.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are and where that shift had occurred, if it was, you know. Well, I'll leave it open for you to ask.
Yeah, that's a great question, and many people wonder, well, there's this fantastic tradition of no waste, and what happened to that? And to a large degree, it persisted in Japan into the 20th century, probably until the post-war period. Really, the overall system, in terms of self-sufficiency and only consuming what you can produce locally, this started to break down during the Meiji period, the late 19th century, when suddenly they're importing coal to power trains and factories, etc. They opened themselves up to the overall economy and sort of lost that link to the forests that was so important. So they didn't have to take care of the forests as much, but this, what they call the motainai, let's not waste anything. That value really persisted in most places until after the Second World War. You can almost say that it was a government policy. No one really forced them to. The Japanese themselves often say, well, it was American influence. And it was a receptivity to American influence and economic reality, as the government made a lot of decisions to increase consumption that led to that. What you're talking about, in fact, though, we all benefited, all foreigners who lived in Japan, we basically furnished our apartments from discards that we found on the street. Those people didn't throw it away expecting anyone to use it. It was only the crazy foreigners who would like an old TV. We did that. But now, as of about 8 or 9 years ago, new laws were passed concerning recycling and discards. That means that people can't do that anymore. In fact, I'll go on a bit of a digression. I refinished a room in my house recently. I used to have 4.5 tatami mats, and I was making an office, so I put down flooring, and I had to get rid of the tatami mats. They were actually okay to be reused if someone wanted them, but no one was going to do that, so I had them outside, and I had to pay 3,000 yen, like $30 a piece, to throw them away, which I thought that would be expensive. You have to contact the government, contact the city to come take it away. One day, Jehovah's Witnesses show up at my door. They come every now and then. The Mormons come, Jehovah's Witnesses come, and I talked to him a bit, and the guy said, hey, what are you going to do with those tatami mats? And I said, I'm looking for somewhere to get rid of them. He said, I'll take them for you. He says, I recycle tatami mats. I said, you recycle tatami mats? What do you do? He says, oh, I take them apart and I sell the straw to farmers to use for their fields. I thought, amazing. I will go see this. And I visited the guy. He was not far away, and he had worked out this way he made a thing that would cut the edges, and he would get a 1,000 yen for each mat to be carted away, and then he would make about 600 yen from selling the straw to farmers. I thought, this is great. So the values are continued, but it really is almost extinct, unfortunately. There are grassroots movements, though, all around, to restore Satoyama, to recycle more thoroughly, towards organic farming, towards permaculture, for instance. But basically, it is a value that needs to be revived. Yes. Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you for the talk today. I've been fascinated by it because I'm both an environmental engineering and a Japanese scholar myself.
Great.
One thing I wanted to hear from your perspective on was the motivations that led to a lot of this cultural emphasis on reuse was scarcity and the prevailing economic climate of the day. For example, if we didn't have the Hinin doing the collection of the human waste and things like that, you'd have had no workforce that would have been willing to do that, similar with the butchers. There are a lot of social equity issues that are associated with having both the manpower and the, I almost want to say, level of poverty necessary to motivate this sort of reuse.
Yes.
And therefore, in a society like we have, we're very used to not just egalitarianism, but also abundance.
Yes.
The motivation for this sort of thing is a little lost, and I'm wondering how you would see a way to bridge that gap.
For today?
Yes.
It's interesting because even in our society, gathering and recycling, people gathering trash or empty cans, it's often carried out by people who are very marginally employed, homeless. In other parts of the world, there are almost permanent underclasses who engage in that behavior, and yet they're playing an important role. We've heard of cases where cities, for instance, in India, go to a new trash collection system, and suddenly hundreds of people are out of work. I think we need to look at this and perhaps maintain a lot of these opportunities for recycling for these people. We would like to eliminate the unegalitarianism. We would like to. Perhaps if we do that, then we find a different type of entrepreneurship, maybe becomes mechanized. Maybe it's another system entirely. But in fact, the reality is that we do have economic inequities, and these are good jobs for a lot of people. Japan at the period was anything but egalitarianism. It was absolutely the threat of death, you know, hung over people, although it was rarely, you know, rarely things got to that point. By and large, the government made a lot of wise decisions and sort of left things alone. And one of their most important roles was as an information gathering and dissemination organ. So they would send researchers all over the country to find out what was happening in cities and farms and to do research, for instance, in new farming techniques, etc., and then get those textbooks and those manuals out. And another characteristic I didn't really touch on was that it was a very highly literate society and a very a society with a lot of ambition and a lot of tinkerers and inventors. So there was a lack of egalitarianism that really depended on this very heavy-handed governance, which in effect, though, in day-to-day life, was very laissez-faire. So we can't do this the same way. However, the idea of, you know, giving candy to kids to bring, you know, recyclables, that's a great idea. We wouldn't do it today in America. We'd consider it some kind of danger, but it really is the kind of idea that we need. Yes, someone else?
Couple questions, actually.
Sure.
Briefly, could you bring us up to date on what a typical Tokyo household has to do in terms of recycling?
That's great. Have you been in Tokyo recently?
I lived there 10 years ago,
okay.
And it was much more extensive than it was than it
yeah.
is here.
I was surprised when I've been in Japan for 25 years, and when I first got there, I thought, wow, they're not recycling. Why are they so behind the times? And on the one hand, energy use was a lot less than it is here. A lot of energy efficiency, and again, this is basically frugality, people not wanting to waste, you know, gas and electricity. But I thought they were just not recycling like they should. Fast forward to today, most municipalities have instituted what we would consider almost draconian recycling codes. In our household in Yokohama, we have to separate our garbage into about 6 different categories. For instance, empty cans, empty polyethylene bottles, glass, paper, plastics, which means mostly packaging materials, and then wet garbage. And things like newspapers are handled differently. And people do this. I mean, Japan is fascinating because often there's a lot of inertia before change happens. But once it's clear that almost everybody's on board with something, then it turns on a dime. So the laws were passed, and they tried it, and well, there were problems. For instance, people were throwing away, you know, cans along with the plastic bottles. So they instituted ordinances where the garbage bags have to be transparent. So suddenly you can see. And also, again, behavior, and this is social norms and social, values, also work very well, because instead of having garbage cans in front of your house, there's a collection point in your neighborhood, and you're part of the neighborhood association. That's the collection point with set days, and there's usually somebody, it's a rotating task, someone has to sort of keep an eye on that, and they know, oh, this is Mr. Brown's house, you know, again, he put out the wet garbage on the can day, and I'll hear about it. I don't do that, of course, but I would hear about it. So it works very, very well. And on the other hand, I hear more and more about advances in automation for sorting garbage that may well make that obsolete. But I would think even if it was capable, if we were able to just have it done automatically, it's better for people to think about it. And it's not onerous, you know. It's just I'm thinking about this plastic bottle and where it has to go. I'm thinking about this can and where it has to go. I believe that we should be mindful in that way. And that's something that we're really missing, and that's a big quality of Japanese society in the traditional sense that we could learn from.
Well, I guess I'll take this time to ask another question.
Yeah, another question? Sure.
As an architect, how do you think we can use Edo sensibilities in terms of modern design?
We could split it up into several areas. One really, really powerful side of Japanese traditional architecture is natural cooling. Again, the houses were built to be comfortable in the summer. And it meant that airflow was very well designed. These are people without any real formal engineering understanding of air pressure, but they designed houses with a lot of openable partitions, with gardens either in the center of the house or in a small courtyard in the back that were moister and cooler, would cool the air as it went through the house, and you could adjust it almost infinitely to get airflow through even in the worst summer months. They're almost always very, very comfortable. So this passive cooling in the summer is one great example. Another example might be, again, energy, in terms of energy use, the Japanese tradition, and even today, people don't heat the whole house. When they say they have central heating, what they mean is they have systems with a heater in each room. And they don't, the idea of heating an entire house or cooling an entire house would be absolutely insane. Why, you know, use energy to change the temperature of a room you're not in? In the old days, there were charcoal braziers, the hibachis, and other small local heaters. But even today, people do that. So I think we could learn from that as well. There's a lot to be said about small footprint housing, compact housing. Again, I've done a lot of research with this, written a book about it, and finding ways to make a very comfortable living space without having it be too big. In the States, maybe some of you know, Sarah Suzanka's The Not So Big House series. She's really worked in the same area and has a lot of wonderful ideas, you know, going away from this McMansion preposterous megalomania, understanding what comfort means. It doesn't mean just bigness, although we're by and large larger people. At least some of you are, I'm not, but larger people. We need more space, but it's possible to design compact houses that are very, very comfortable. And in fact, last year I was contacted by a group in New York City called the Citizens Housing Planning Council, which was begun in the 1930s to influence housing policy in New York. It's a non-governmental organization, but has the ear of the government, and they were looking at an increase of population in New York in the next 20 years of a million people. And this is in a city that already has a housing shortage. And they're looking at the building codes and saying, my goodness, these building codes were written at a time when the nuclear household was the norm. But now nuclear households are only 17% of the households in New York. The rest are singles or people living with roommates or other non-traditional household forms. They also looked at things like the minimum sizes allowable for baths and kitchens, which were largely based on fire codes and safety codes, and saying, well, you know, we look at Japan. And they called me and a Japanese architect named Mr. Utsumi, and we made presentations and said, you know, the Japanese are re-engineering this stuff. They're thinking about the limitations in a very different way, making very efficient and comfortable and safe new forms of dwellings that take up less space and are better for energy and every other use. So the city of New York, for instance, right now, is very receptive to this. And this is kind of baffling to Japanese who assume that their lifestyle is inferior, this whole idea of living in rabbit hutches, which was a very, you know, insulting thing that was said about 30 years ago that stung them. They think their whole housing is inferior, whereas, in fact, they're more ahead of the curve, and the rest of the world is fairly ready now to learn from that. So those are just a few aspects. There's quite a few others, but I think those are two big ones. Yes, sir.
It's my understanding that the taxing and licensing of personal automobiles in Japan was set up so that the longer you had it, the more expensive it was to
yes.
buy a license, the purpose being so that the average Japanese would have to sell their car after 2 years and buy a new one,
yes.
and that was a means of keeping the Japanese car industries going.
Yes.
I suppose the cars were recycled, were recycled, but sort of from the point of view of energy, this is using an enormous amount of energy, which the Japanese have to import from whether they can buy coal overseas, which seems very much far removed from the methods of the Edo period. So is this going on a lot in Japan?
It still
in
is.
The industry?
The system hasn't changed. The automobile industry, the tax system is the same. You buy a car, it's very expensive to get what we'd call a brake tag, right? A registration. $1,000 or so or more when you buy the car, and then $200 every couple of years afterwards, 5 years initially, and then every 2 years. It's very expensive. That's exactly what you said. It was a way of subsidizing the automobile industry. At the moment, we can see that that's a very bad idea from a lot of respects. If there's any a positive side to that. It's that automobiles have gotten more fuel efficient and, you know, better in terms of recycling and environmentally, you know, less damaging as time goes on. So it's good to replace the fleet, so to speak, but you're absolutely right. I would contrast that to the electrical appliance industry, which in recent years has really done a lot of very good things in terms of environmental consciousness. Almost every Japanese appliance is much more efficient in terms of electricity use and other things. For instance, my washing machine now, they have they're using intelligence and electronics to minimize the amount of water or detergent that you need. So you throw the laundry in, you push it and it starts and it senses the load and how dirty it is and then just uses enough water and detergent for that particular load. At the same time, recent appliances, and this is under strong government incentive to do it, are much more easy to recycle. And what that means is that they're more easy to disassemble. You can take them apart and the plastic pieces come off and the metal pieces come off and it's much more easy to recycle them. So there are a lot of good things happening. They don't go nearly far enough. And what you're talking about, the automobile industry, is absolutely true. I think they should discourage Japanese people from owning automobiles. I mean, the public transportation system is so sophisticated and so efficient in most parts of the country, most cities, people don't need them. If they could work out an alternate, and I would think everything from reviving the use of rivers and canals for transportation or transportation of goods to, you know, implementing new underground systems that might take the load off of individual vehicles on the road, there's a lot of things they could do and should do, which I think would be very important. Yes, someone else over here? Yes.
You touched a little bit about importing coal, but
yes,
don't you think that there's sort of a fundamental cultural difference in that they were on an island?
Yes.
And we always had the go west young man.
Right.
There's always a new frontier to be conquered.
Right.
So if you could talk a little bit about, and then fast forward to them. So it seems sort of like we're passing. They're trying to emulate us now, and we're trying to. You're trying to.
Yeah, I'm trying to point out. You know.
So yeah. Because it just seems like
this has happened so many times.
With the island, you know, island. There, that's it. You know.
And yeah, it's an island culture. Very inward-looking. Self-sufficiency was a question of survival back then, to a greater degree than it was for even North American pioneers, perhaps, and greater degree than it was in Europe. Definitely, the rest of the world has emulated or has, you know, tried to imitate the Western material lifestyle. And we can see how unwise that is. I look at this even in simple things like city planning, the role of large buildings in cities, where we understand the problems with those things, but every other city in the world wants those things as emblems of progress and of respect, as ways of commanding respect. It's easy to make people feel inferior or embarrassed about how they live. I think the case, again, back to Japan and living in small spaces, I believe that fundamentally Japanese people like to be in rooms where they're really rubbing elbows with the other people. There's a lot of bars and places to go eat yakitori where you can barely squeeze in, and it's really very social, and it's a wonderful way to be together. And I have pictures that I sometimes show of homes, households decades ago where people all huddled around a little table, a little kotatsu in the winter, and they're really touching each other, and they like that, except most people now don't want to admit that they prefer that. That seems to be unsophisticated. Makes them feel a bit self-conscious because their image of a nice lifestyle is a big table and, you know, everything's big and wide open and clean. So there's a huge disjunction between what people might really prefer and be happy with and what they think they should prefer. And this happens all over the world. Japan is not the only case. At the same time, yes, we are now and far too late receptive to learning from what we would call indigenous cultures, indigenous ways of dealing with these issues of food and energy and environmental control. We're much receptive to it, but it's far too late. I mean, most of those systems, like in the case of Japan, it has basically disappeared. We're trying to reconstruct it to some degree, and this happens elsewhere as well. So this is part of the history of Western culture and its relationship with the rest of the world, kind of getting in and, you know, the effect, even when it's unintentional – is that like a bulldozer, and people just love this stuff, and you know, it's so attractive, and they want that lifestyle, and then in many cases, when they understand what they've lost, it's almost too late to reconstruct or recapture it. So, yes, it's a very fascinating dynamic. Anyone else?
I have a question.
Sure.
If no one else has one. The Edo period cities seem somewhat haphazardly planned or unplanned, but are there lessons that you've learned from Edo city planning that might be helpful to us for future city planning here?
I'd say that the idea that they were haphazardly planned is an illusion. I think they reflect a kind of structure and relation to the natural topography that is more organic, in fact. It's a different kind of structure. In the case of Edo itself, the layout of the city reflected the social classes. It had the samurai were the upper class, and there were temples with priests, etc. There were commoners, there were craftspeople, and they all were sort of segregated into areas based on their class and really their role in society. The areas that commoners lived in Edo were very, very rationally laid out. They were laid out in grids with inner courtyards and subdivided into very small little plots to fit a lot of people. In fact, during the Edo period, those neighborhoods of where the commoners lived were denser in population than the densest wards of Tokyo are today. It's kind of unbelievable because we have high rises, but they actually had more people living in the same amount of land and living fairly comfortably. We think they must have been slums. There were slums, but these were people of all walks of life living there. They weren't all slums. They were actually, in most cases, very livable places. In the case of the samurai classes in Edo, Edo had a lot of hills. It's maybe not that different from San Francisco in some respects. A lot of hills, and those were the areas that were sort of set aside for major temples and for the samurai to live. Their streets and everything followed the natural topography, so that it looks irregular, but in fact, again, it was quite systematic. And that the samurai, I would have liked to have touched on this today, but as time went on, these are people who are living on a fixed stipend from the government, depending on their rank. There was a natural inflation, and they were having a hard time making ends meet. But they were given a plot of land that was maybe twice the size of their house, if not larger, and they had room for gardens. They were expected to have a garden. And as time went on, they devoted more and more of their gardens to raising vegetables. And by the end of the period, by the late 18th century, you had literally hundreds of thousands of samurai families doing urban farming. It was urban farming on a scale that we have not seen perhaps anywhere else since then. I mean, we might look at the Victory Gardens in the United States or in England during the Second World War, and certainly Japan and other countries had similar things, but these were gardens, farms in the city that were continued for generations. So it looks haphazard, but in every respect, how they integrated the natural water flow, for instance, the gardens included things like, well, ponds, which are in fact wetlands. You know, they may be artificially designed, but these provide habitat for animals. They have fish, they have turtles, they have all sorts of, insects living there. Birds can come and feed. Their gardens had fruit and nut trees, providing food for them, and also, again, habitat and food for other animals. So it looks haphazard when we think of urban planning, but yet it was very, very rationally laid out on a different level. Someone else? Sure.
In your book, you have a section on lessons learned.
Right.
What would you say is the most important lesson?
I think the most important lesson is, I like to give two lessons. One is paying attention, again, to the upstream, you know, where the things we're using come from and really what's involved with that in terms of energy and water and the environment, and what happens to them when we're done with it, also in the same respect. To really pay attention to that, because these people did, again, it was a question of livelihood, if not survival. In our case, we have to recognize that we really are in an emergency situation, and we need to do that. And I think the way to solve our problems is to approach the problems in a similar fashion. What I was talking about, multi-form solutions, to understand the linkages and how, you know, what you do with water is going to affect perhaps your forest, or what you do with your waste will affect your water or your food supply, and to see those things as linked systems. And this is something that we're not taught to do. And our education system and all of our bureaucracies are much more isolated. I mean, we sort of look at this horrible problem in the Gulf of Mexico and these sort of great dysfunctions with communication and people not understanding what the other guy is doing. We need to really see these linkages and maybe even develop people who are generalists. I mean, we need generalists now who can understand these connections. And I believe the greatest thing we can learn about it is from that problem-solving approach. How you define the problem at the beginning, the parameters, what you're taking into consideration, from the outset will largely determine the quality of the outcome you will find. And this is something that we should learn from.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
So our thanks to Asbie Brown, author of his new book, Just Enough, Lessons in Living Green from Traditional Japan. We are going to be selling his book in the library following this program. And Asbie, I think you've agreed to stay and sign books.
Happy to sign books.
And I have to say, the charming illustrations that you saw today, many of them are included in his book. And he did them himself.
Yes.
Which he humbly...
I colored them for the presentation. The book, they're black and white, but they're all in the book.
Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you very much.